Welcome to Worlds Apart. As the Chinese war strategist Sun Tzu posited more than 2,500 years ago, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you don't need to fear the result of 100 battles. But what if you don't? The war in Ukraine has already led to a plethora of unforeseen strains on the global economy, and analysts warn that worse may be yet to come. How well do the protagonists in this drama understand their roles, their aims, and their limits? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Beijing by Victor Gao, Vice President of the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Gao, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in one of your articles prior to the beginning of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, you warned that this crisis may degenerate into a melodrama with potentially devastating global consequences. And I think we are all witnessing that melodrama or tragedy now. Do you think, though, that it may still lead to some sort of a Hollywood-style happy ending, or should we prepare ourselves for a much more sober, much more darker culmination?
You are raising a very important question. I think it is time for mankind to look beyond into the future. I think we can start with the year 2122, that is 100 years from today. And I can see two extremely different scenarios for the military operations or the war in Ukraine. One extreme scenario is the disappearance of the world and the Homo sapien from the surface of the earth. And who is the victim? Who is the bully? What happened to Ukraine? What happened to Russia? What happened to the United States? It doesn't matter. The whole world will be gone. Now, the other extreme is that Ukraine becomes one of the wealthiest countries in Europe and in the world. But it cannot happen unless on several conditions. One is the neutrality for Ukraine, and Ukraine becomes friends with all and enemy with none, and Ukraine become a major connectivity center linking north to the south, east to the west, and really devotes itself to peaceful development and economic growth. In that way, Ukraine truly will be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. I do hope we can see the brighter side of the situation and do our best to prevent the catastrophe or Armageddon from happening as a result of military operations in Ukraine.
Now, both of these scenarios, looking 100 years into the future, I think much in line with the Chinese proclivity towards the long view of history, but let's stay in the moment for now and let's talk about what led to the current confrontation, because I think we would both agree that Russia and the United States, as the leader of NATO, have been on a collision course for a number of years, and apparently both of them have decided that there is no other way to settle their irreconcilable security differences than to go to an open conflict. Do you think there was any other alternative, non-military alternative, to settling their differences on the security status of Ukraine?
Well, first of all, whatever that is happening in Ukraine today is very tragic and very unfortunate. In a sense, it could have been prevented. You know, lots of people in the West now argue that Russia could have prevented the military operations or war in Ukraine. I would say the United States could have prevented it from happening, or NATO could have prevented it from happening. Now, on February the 24th, people thought that the war or the military operations were fought between Russia on the one hand and Ukraine on the other hand. I think today most people realize that the military operations is between Russia on one hand and Ukraine in the front with the United States and NATO behind it. So this is the complicating factor for the military operations in Ukraine. I think if anyone in the West, either the United States or NATO members, could have made it known that for Ukraine to join NATO is a dead end. It will not happen, and it should not happen. Then I think Russia would have no reason to go into Ukraine to engage in this military operation to start with. Now, on the other hand, Russia has made it clear that the eastward expansion of NATO should not continue to Russia's doorstep. Russia did not mention this one day. It has mentioned this for years, for several decades, as a matter of fact. And the continual expansion of NATO is in contravention of all the promises the United States made to Russia after 1991, when the former Soviet Union dissolved.
As far as I'm concerned, it's not just a matter of broken promises. I think you even wrote about that in one of your articles, that President Putin had ample reason to conclude that NATO's expansion into Ukraine and the deployment of medium-range missiles there would fundamentally change Russia's security profile. And this is not some abstract ideological thing, because Putin, as the commander-in-chief, as well as the Russian army, have the obligation, the duty to react to that. This is not their whim. This is their duty to protect Russia's security interests. Do you think people in the West, the decision makers in the West, understood that? Because I assume they're also bound by similar obligations before their people. Or do you think they consciously counted on Russia's being timid and not responding to that threat?
Well, ever since February the 24th, leaders in the Western countries condemned the military operations in Ukraine, citing that Ukraine was a sovereign country and it could decide which bloc to join or not to join. However, they choose to disregard one fundamental factor, that is, the security for one country should not be insecurity for other countries. And the best example is, ironically, the 1962 Cuba Missile Crisis, because no one denied that back in 1962, the former Soviet Union was a sovereign country, Cuba was a sovereign country. So by following this logic that the Western countries are using today, then former Soviet Union and Cuba had absolute sovereign power to decide where to base the missiles of the former Soviet Union in Cuba. So why should the United States jump out? Why should President Kennedy jump out and obstruct and object to the deployment of Soviet missiles in Cuba? And why should President Kennedy be ranked as one of the greatest presidents in U.S. history? Because the United States and President Kennedy did have reason to believe that missiles to be deployed in Cuba would change the security profile of the United States. And they want to do everything they can to prevent that from happening.
But therefore, at the same time, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that at that point of time in history, the United States wasn't the only superpower. It wasn't the exceptional nation. It was one of the two, or perhaps one of a larger number of countries with a lot of influence. Do you think that this fundamental psychological change within the American psyche allowed for this conflict to happen?
I think now, with the benefit of hindsight, the United States up to February the 24th, 2022, did want to see that the land of Ukraine could be used by the United States or NATO member states to base their troops or missiles, which may eventually threaten the interest of Russia. Now, this is truly very mistaken. I think there are responsible people in the United States who objected to the expansion of NATO into Ukraine, not back in 2021 or 2022, but as early as in the last decade. And I think this speaks very eloquently to the risks of Ukraine becoming a NATO member state. Because by joining NATO, it will really deprive security from Russia. And it will change the landscape in terms of geopolitics in that part of the world for many, many years to come.
Now, there is an old saying that war is what happens when language fails. Do you see any signs 4 months into this conflict? Do you see any signs that either Russia or the West, the United States specifically, are ready to give language a second chance, this time to try to find an end to this war?
Well, objectively speaking, if you look at NATO, it's not monolithic. There are different member states of NATO which have very, very different desires as far as the military operations or war in Ukraine is concerned. Europe is not monolithic. I think, at least on the surface, the United States and Great Britain had all the reason to make sure that the war continues. And sometimes extreme elements in those countries even urge that the war be expanded to Russia, or even drive the Russian government out of existence, or even to divide Russia into several pieces. Now, this is not going to happen. Why? Because Russia is not only a very proud nation, it has the largest, most lethal nuclear weapon system in the world. And I don't think anyone should realistically expect that they can put Russia into the corner, humiliate Russia, and achieve their goals in the day. I think a negotiated peace involving Ukraine is the only way out of this dilemma. And it requires not only two to tangle, that is Russia and Ukraine, it requires Russia on the one hand and Ukraine plus the United States plus Great Britain and many other NATO member states to tangle together collectively to make sure that the war is not prolonged and peace be restored.
Now, in my introduction, I mentioned a host of unforeseen consequences that this crisis has already put on the global economy. And if we look at the Western economy in particular, and all the forecasts that we are now seeing for where fuel prices are going to be, the oil price is projected to hover around $140 per barrel through the year, that changes production calculus in the West, the production side for many companies to a significant extent. That in itself presents a huge risk to Western industrial base. As Western strategists are thinking about sanctioning Russia, or punishing Russia for what it has done, do you think they are calculating in the cost of this policy for themselves?
Well, first of all, sanctions themselves will not achieve their goal. The United States sanctioned Cuba for decades, and Cuba, by the end of the day, is still standing as a proud member of the international community. Sanctions against Russia, for what? It will make Russia very, very difficult, to make life in Russia difficult, but whether it will force Russia to be crumbled or force Russia to call uncle, no, I don't think so.
Well, Mr. Gao, I have no doubt that Russia will survive, but let's focus on the implications for the West. In your writing, you often refer to the golden rule, don't do unto others what you don't want to be done unto yourself. Do you think we are now at the point where when the golden rule is becoming a boomerang law?
Absolutely. The economic sanctions against Russia are mutually destructive. It is very bad for the European countries and Western countries in general. Why? Because it creates all lots of pressure for countries like Germany, and no country is exempted. Even the United States or Great Britain are suffering from the repercussions of these unilaterally imposed sanctions. It causes financial crisis, energy crisis, food crisis, you name it. It really destroys peace and growth, for example, not for Russia alone, but for so many other countries. And the international community itself is a victim. We are all losers in a sense. Therefore, I think it is crucially important to bring the sanctions to a stop, to lift all these sanctions. And also allow me to emphasize, I don't think there will be lasting peace in Europe by excluding Russia, or there will be lasting peace in the world by excluding Russia. Eventually, these countries need to come to terms with the fact that Russia is an important factor in the world of politics today, and Russia need to be engaged with rather than excluded. Excluding Russia has all the perils involved in it. It will not solve the problem. It will make the whole crisis even worse.
Well, Mr. Gower, essentially you're saying that these nations have to come to terms with reality and geography, whether or not they like Russia. Russia exists, and this is a fact hard to change. But for the time being, we need to take a short break. We will be back to this fascinating discussion in a few moments. Stay tuned.
Putin is the aggressor. Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions.
Today, Russia is the country with the most sanctions imposed against it, a number that's constantly growing.
Стратегия сейчас направлена на сокрушение российской экономики, на нанесение максимального ущерба.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
Sucks, like we're suffering the price for something that's happening in another country.
Вопрос узловой, который сейчас решается, это судьба доллара как мировой резервной валюты.
Joe Biden, in imposing these sanctions on Russia, you know, has destroyed the American economy. So there's your boomerang effect.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense?
Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Victor Gao, Vice President of the Center for China and Globalization. Mr. Gao, before the break, we were discussing various implications of the war in Ukraine, and many Russian, and not only Russian thinkers, see it as part of a much broader rebalancing of the international system, spurred in part by China's rise and China's struggle, for now contained struggle with the West for influence and development opportunities. Do you think this Sino-Western rivalry, which is primarily economic at this point, but also has security elements to it, do you think there is a possibility of it blowing out openly?
Well, allow me to mention several things. In the world of today, China and Russia have strong peace, and our long border of more than 4,300 kilometers long has been peaceful ever since 1989. And the people-to-people relations between China and Russia are very, very solid. This is a fact, and no one should change this, and no pressure from any country in the West, including the United States, can change the fundamental nature of good friendship and a good neighborliness between China and Russia. Now, on the other hand, China has completely transformed itself over the past 43 years by embracing the world order as it is, even though we acknowledge there are many defects and problems in the world order, mainly because there is one superpower, that is the United States, which wants to dictate terms to other countries. And China does not want to be dictated and to be imposed with all these values or systems, et cetera, unilaterally to be imposed by the United States on China. Therefore, China does not want to destroy the current international order. After all, countries like the former Soviet Union and today's Russia and China, we sacrificed so much to defeat Nazism and Japanese imperialism in 1945. We were the contributor and the builder of the current international security order as it is today, is that right? So we want to make sure that the international order is maintained, but all the problems and defects are corrected. We want to rally around the United Nations. This is what China stands for. China stands for peace and development, and China wants to be friends with all and enemy with none. Mm-hmm. And China wants to further enhance its relations and cooperation with all the countries in the world if they want to treat China as an equal and deal with China with respect.
You mentioned development, and I recently came across a fascinating fact about China, that your country has the largest network of bullet trains with the same distance covered in 3 hours as compared to 22 hours in the United States. If we take that metaphorically, one may wonder if there's anything that the United States can do to stop China in its tracks. And given how far and how fast you have gone over the last 43 years, what's the worst that your competitors can do to you?
Well, first of all, I think the continued rise of China is inevitable. It is the mega trend of our times. China is already larger than the United States economy if we use purchasing power parity. It is about 80% already of that of the United States if we use official exchange rate. And China is the largest manufacturing country in the world, the largest trading nation in the world. China is the largest trading partner with more than 130 countries in the world. So this is the fact. The United States has to come to terms with this fact rather than deny this is the case or try to change it or to reverse it. I would say to deprive the Chinese nation of their right of economic development probably is the largest crime against humanity, and this should not be tolerated. On the other hand, China does not want to be a superpower replacing the United States. China can get along with all the other countries in the world on equal basis. This is very, very important. The United States' logic is distorted because it believes that once China surpasses that of the United States, China definitely will want to impose its system or its values onto the United States. Nothing is further away from the truth.
But I think that poses a very interesting question, because China has, with a few notable historic exceptions, I think China has never been shy of adopting other countries' best policies for its own good. Do you think the United States will ever come to the point where it would be willing to borrow from China's or any other country's success to use some of the best practices of foreign countries for its own good?
I would say if you use objectivity and rationality to look at the situation in the world ever since 1978 or ever since 1989 or 1991, for example, then you need to conclude that China probably is really performing the best. Why? Because China completely transformed itself and is already in the top league in the countries of the world. So there must be something that China has been doing right and many other countries have failed to do it in the right way. Therefore, I think the United States and many other countries can really learn a lot from China's focus on economic development, maintaining stability, keeping peace, for example. But whether they want to do that or not, it's up to them to decide. And China will not bother to try to force our analysis onto them, because eventually, as Deng Xiaoping said, development is the hard truth. And eventually, you can look at the outcome of the economic development as a key benchmark as to whether you are doing it right or not. China has benefited hugely from globalization, and China remains a major champion of globalization and economic development and innovation. This will be the megatrend. And I hope people in Washington, in the United States, will come to terms with the fact that they will live in a world with another country, that is China, which is significantly larger than the United States, but has no desire to be the next hegemon in the world.
Well, Mr. Gao, despite your hope, I think for now at least, the Americans are still trying to protect their dominant position. And U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently introduced a very interesting term. She talked about friendshoring instead of offshoring, and by that she meant redirecting supply chains to quote unquote trusted countries, and I suppose neither China nor Russia are among them. Do you think Washington has enough economic muscle to pull that off, to redirect the global economic system yet again to its liking and to its benefit?
Thank you very much. I think the U.S. policy in this regard is completely misguided. First of all, Rome was not built overnight, and China's supply chain strength and advantage are not built overnight. And you mentioned the bullet train, for example. China has the largest mileage of bullet train in a matter of a decade, and China has the strongest manufacturing and capabilities in civil engineering projects, you name it, in across the board. So I think to move some of the manufacturing capacities out of China to other countries, that's perfectly okay. But to really change the supply chain in the world today, probably it will take decades, because you are not only talking about manufacturing capacities, you are talking about power generation, infrastructure, roads, transportation, highways, railways, airports, you name it. It really takes a lot of money to build up all these facilities. It takes a lot of effort to train all these skilled workers, for example. And if you talk about supply chain in many, many sectors, you are not talking about one or two factories. You are talking about hundreds, if not thousands of factories. So I think we still need to champion globalization. On the other hand, if any government wants to dictate economic terms to other enterprises, most likely it will fail. The United States cannot dictate terms to the American companies at home. How can they dictate terms to foreign companies operating in China, in ASEAN countries, in other parts of the world? Eventually, it will be fail. It will be a big failure, I would say.
Now, you mentioned the need to champion globalization as it is, and one of the hallmarks of globalization, or at least it used to be one of the hallmarks, is free trade. The Americans no longer talk about free trade. Treasury Secretary Yellen talked about trade free but secure, and before her, President Trump talked about trade free but fair. So the Americans always have some qualifiers when it comes to free trade. And I think we would both agree that what is fair and secure for the Americans is probably not fair and secure for the world or other members of the economic system. But how do you think those issues of fairness should be decided on a global basis now as we transition to indeed a more multipolar and hopefully more equal world?
Well, for trade to be sustainable, it needs to be fair, and hopefully it should be free. However, I think the American government is really misusing these labels. Fair doesn't mean fair. It means fairer to the Americans rather than to the counterparties in China or in other countries. Free doesn't mean free of limitations. It is a free in the political sense of the word, as if the United States has a monopoly on freedom or democracy. The United States actually does not have a perfect record in human rights, in democracy, etc. However, I would say you cannot fool the American people all the time, on all occasions. Sooner or later, the American people will realize that China is a champion of free trade, of market economy, of innovation, of real bold development, and huge investment into infrastructure, into manufacturing, et cetera, which has created benefits not only for the Chinese people, but for the whole mankind everywhere in the world. And sooner or later, I think the United States government need to come to the conclusion that by treating China and Russia as enemies, it's not going to help the United States. It probably will create more headaches for the United States. Eventually, philosophically, as well as realistically, for the United States to treat Russia on the one hand and China on the other hand with respect and deal with them with decency and dignity is the only way out in the world of today.
On this point, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much. Спасибо.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.